You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Three Palestinian groups, including Hamas, Fatah, and Islamic Jihad, agreed today to a ceasefire for 3 months. That's according to ABC News. Peace Watch spoke with Mitch Potter of the Toronto Star in Gaza City about the prospects for peace between Palestine and Israel.
Well, it's been in the works for now weeks. Ever since George Bush was in the region, the time clock began to tick away on an essential ceasefire. Nothing is going to move forward in this region until arms are laid down, even for what they call a temporary ceasefire, a hudna, which is the word in Arabic. And so there has been behind-the-scenes horse trading going on day after day after day, and all sorts of premature reports that this is happening. And three times now it has appeared that it's on the verge of happening, and some terrible event has forestalled it, some missile strike or suicide bombing. And indeed, the very moment that we got word from Palestinian officials that this tentative deal had finally been achieved and it's going to happen, within minutes of that, an Israeli helicopter gunship fired a missile about 20 kilometers south of me in the Gaza Strip on a town called Khan Yunis. And the reports are that as many as 17 people injured and as many as two killed, including one Hamas militant, the Islamic militant group Hamas, an individual by the name of Mohammed Sayem. So this, in fact, could push everything back out the window, and we could be back, if you've ever seen the movie Groundhog Day, just sort of back to zero and starting over again.
Yes, so. I did see that movie. One of the terms of the truce agreement was that Israel stop its targeted killings and military incursions into Palestine. So in light of these most recent events, does this put the ceasefire in complete jeopardy, would you say? Or?
Well, I wouldn't say complete jeopardy, because the stakes with every passing day are getting higher and higher, and I can't express to you how enormous the pressure is on the Palestinian militants in particular, thanks pretty much singularly to U.S. President George Bush. He again today reiterated the fact that Hamas in particular, he isolated them as an enemy of peace. And, you know, the Palestinian militants really appear to have a veto on this entire process. Now, I've spent the past several days in Gaza, the Palestinian territory of Gaza, where Hamas is based here, and I've been doing a lot of work talking to Hamas officials, and I can tell you that it's not a place where you can very easily become enthusiastic or optimistic, but I do really believe there's a sea change in that organization in terms of their ultimate goals. You know, for years, the group was formed in 1987 as an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood with the stated intention of ending the Israeli occupation, but also eliminating the Israeli state. I believe they're dropping that terrible second insistence, and I believe that Hamas is prepared to stand aside and allow for a second state to take place in this region, for in fact the creation of a Palestinian state to end this conflict.
You're saying that now you think they may be willing to actually step back and allow a two-state solution take place. What are their initial demands?
Well, I have to tell you first, to try and get a handle on Hamas and to understand what it is, you have to think almost in labyrinthian terms, because this is a five-headed beast here in the Gaza. There are five leaders. There's one spiritual leader, Sheikh Yassin, who is understood to be sort of the symbolic leader of the movement, but beneath him are four deputies of equal stature who range across the political spectrum from ultra-left to ultra-right, and one of the more centrist leaders who people do have a lot of time for, Abu Shanab. I sat down with him for an hour last night, and I was taken aback. He said in no uncertain terms that it is time to end the rhetoric. He said, we have to face the fact that Israel cannot be defeated, and the practical solution is for us to have a state alongside Israel. Now, he is more in the centrist or left camp within Hamas, but for that statement, which I think really takes the organization further than I've ever heard it go before, to come from his lips is really saying something. And in further investigations in the Gaza, I think you can read the crystal ball anyway. Is it because of the threat that these individuals will die They are now being threatened with missile attacks on the actual leadership. Or is it the pressure that the Egyptians and the Americans are placing on drying up the funding of the organization? Or indeed, is it the fact that Hamas is not just a military organization? It has five different humanitarian aid wings inside the Gaza Strip, and it's a lifeblood to the people here. And maybe they're terrified of that the baby will be thrown out with the bathwater, that in going after this organization, it is going to cripple Palestinian society, which is so dependent on these humanitarian aid organizations, especially now.
What do you see happening next with Abu Shanaf making this type of statement? Is he high enough in the hierarchy of the Hamas organization for that statement to be significant and for it to help to shape the policy moving forward?
He does have some clout in the equation, but what you will see, and I think what already has taken place but they haven't formally announced, is that there's been what they call a shura, a council of leaders. And in fact, it's a kind of grassroots democracy. Think of it as an Islamic boardroom table. And they've weighed their votes in, and the vote is for a hudna, a ceasefire to take hold for 3 months. Now, any further military action on the part of Israel, and in fact the one that happened earlier today might be enough, will forestall this. It might delay the actual announcement of that by a few days. What we've heard today is that there's a tentative agreement in place. They've come to an understanding. They're ready to make this move. They're ready to bring a ceasefire forth. But everything is so fragile here that it could easily fall apart in the next day or two. I don't think that means all this work is a waste. I do believe that at the end of the day, sooner or later, the pressure on these organizations is going to bring us to a three-month window. So when you ask what happens next, well, that 3 months is going to make or break this initiative for the U.S. administration and for the possibility of peace in the foreseeable future. In that three-month window, when suicide bombings end, when Israeli incursions end, everything that's written into the roadmap as developed by the so-called international quartet has to move, and it has to move quickly. And I think everybody is on board with that. I think you're going to see a frantic pressure change in the region. The pressure won't be simply on the militant Palestinians. It will also be on Israel to pony up and deliver on things like pulling out of the settlement outposts in the West Bank, lifting the curfews, lifting the restrictions on Palestinian society, so that people can at least begin to breathe a little bit here and see that a day without bombings is a day that is better in the life of the Middle East.
It sounds as if we can dare to start to seriously hope for peace. Is it possible peace could be on the horizon in the Middle East?
Oh, boy. You know, you always have to have hope, don't you? It's so easy to become cynical, especially when you're living right on top of this region. There are a great many people who are convinced that it's impossible for Palestinians and Israelis to achieve peace on their own. They must be forced to make peace because they're not capable of doing it on their own. It is a Gordian knot of violence. They have their hands on each other's throats, and they are not saying ouch. And the fear is that if one is to let go before the other, then they will receive all the pain. And so only a third party can intervene in this. And I think that's why we're seeing movement now, because I think that third party is the Bush administration. And really, everything depends on George Bush.
Mitch Potter of the Toronto Star speaking with us from Gaza City. Tomorrow we'll continue our discussion with Mitch, and he'll give us a sense of a life in the day of a Palestinian living under the Israeli occupation. As peace negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians inch tenuously ahead, Farah Charmchi of Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston has this report on one university professor who's applying his study on conflict resolution to his analysis of events in the Middle East.
Here's a story for those of you who think academic research is unrelated to the real world. Bruce Wexler, a professor of psychiatry at Yale University, studies brain development and human culture. He's observed, as have many others, that humans are unique in that we both shape and are shaped by our environment. Dr. Wexler began wondering about what implications this finding has for the world of conflict resolution, especially the conflict between Palestinians and Israelis. He explained to us his work and how we might use this knowledge to help make our environment more peaceful.
Human development as a species is an era, the last couple of thousand years, when cultures that had formerly been isolated from one another have had increasing contact. Now, cultures develop in such isolation among people that even today there are 5,000 different languages spoken, not counting dialects, 5,000 languages, each representing a community that lived in isolation long enough to develop its own language. So it's only in the last couple thousand years that there's been a lot of contact among these communities, and I'm not the first one to point this out, but almost all that contact, and we see it all around the world, has been problematic and violent because people fight to try and control the external public space, their symbols, their beliefs in that space as being prominent. And it's particularly difficult for them when their children are exposed to a different culture and when their children start to adopt some of the characteristics of the different culture. So that was my analysis, and I thought that was at play here in the Middle East. And the Middle East is a place that's just been for centuries of extreme importance symbolically to multiple communities, the Jewish, the Muslim, and the Christian communities. And I didn't think that particular dimension of the conflict was one that the diplomats and the generals were very sensitive to or very well positioned to deal with. And I thought that was getting in the way of their efforts. And I wondered for a while where the religious leaders were on the other side of it, why the religious leaders weren't speaking up for the values within each of their cultures that were inconsistent with the violence, and why they weren't upset that the holiest city for their religions was being defiled by violence all the time, and the Holy Land was. And so that prompted me to think how one could intervene in this public idea space, change what's in the public idea space. And the idea would be, we can't change cultures. It's going to be difficult for people to live together who have such different cultures. But what we can do is find values within each culture that are supportive of the efforts of mutual understanding and that are opposed to the violence, and strengthen those voices and those values from within each culture.
Believing that the majority of populations on both sides of the conflict actually support moderate positions, Dr. Wexler did some homework. One of his findings was that there are already over 50 organizations of some combination of Israelis, Palestinians, Jordanians, and Americans working cooperatively for peace. Other research further supported his hypotheses.
There was a poll conducted by the University of Maryland at the request of an organization called Search for Common Ground, and it found that over 70% of Israelis and over 70% of Palestinians endorsed essentially the same peace plan. And the reservations in each community were only and primarily that there wasn't a partner on the other side, that their view of what they'd be willing to accept for peace would not be accepted by the other side, and that violence would continue to be emanate from the other side. But both sides felt that, and both sides were ready to agree, over 70%. Agreed to a very, very similar sketch of what a peace plan would be.
Dr. Wexler tells about the difficulty of getting even apparently major trends recognized in the news.
Yitzhak Frankenthal started a telephone service in Jerusalem called Hello Shalom and Hello Salam, and that it's staffed by operators, and any Palestinian can call up and say, I want to talk to an Israeli. And any Israeli can call up and say, I want to talk to a Palestinian. In the first 3 months of operation this past fall, there were 130,000 phone calls made. 260,000 people on either ends of those phones talking to each other. No news coverage of that fact in this country. Most people who are very concerned about the problems in the Middle East and follow it closely don't even know this exists. That, it seems to me, should be more newsworthy. And it's a matter of pushing the story. And it's not held out because it's too controversial. It's held out because it's too soft, is what we learned from the news people. What sells is the definition of news is when something bad happens to somebody, according to the news experts that we talk to. Or that quote, if it bleeds, it leads. This is the type of thing that American news covers, and partly because American news is competing with other things for people's attention, especially on television, and it has to compete with entertainment.
What he needed now was to discover why this third voice, this alternative voice that he claims represents the mainstream but is radically underrepresented in the media, is so often drowned out or excluded. For this, he began to ask how we frame and analyze the problem of the conflict.
Well, there's a lack of sophistication and resources, as you point out. There's what the definition of news is, and there's also an analysis of what the problem is. Now, this was very interesting in our meeting. One of the news experts at our meeting was explaining that if you had some news about what you were going to do about the settlement problem, or what you were going to do about the governance of Jerusalem, those are the real problems that have to be solved, is what this news person said. So that's what we report about, things relevant to that. But it depends on what your analysis is. Now, I heard Shlomo Ben-Ami, the former foreign minister of Israel and the chief negotiator at Camp David, and Hassan Rahman, who was in the Palestinian negotiating group at those same meetings, both said to me, and said publicly at a meeting here at Yale, that the major problem is one of trust. Not the particulars of the diplomatic solution, it's a matter of trust. So if you think that that's the problem, then these other images are very newsworthy. But the news editors don't operate with that level of analysis of what the problem is. And it's actually that what prompted me to try and initiate this effort, because I thought that the way that the diplomats and generals and many of the news editors were analyzing the problem in terms of certain diplomatic particulars of where you draw the line was only part of the problem. And a big part of the problem, which they weren't able to address, was the issue of trust and mistrust. And it's these other images that have to be in the news to deal with the issue of trust. So my third reason in answer to your question is what the news editors think the nature of the problem is. And if they only analyze it in terms of boundaries and governance issues, that's what they think is newsworthy. If they understood that part of the problem, a very big part of the problem, is one of distrust of people who have been at war and who come from different backgrounds, then they would see that these other activities of cooperation and mutual understanding are actually newsworthy.
Dr. Wexler's response to what he learned at that point was to co-found an organization whose purpose is to change public perceptions, particularly of Palestinians and Israelis, about the good faith of their counterparts in the peacemaking effort.
Our organization, A Different Future, primary goal is to promote peace between Palestinians and Israelis. And our particular approach to this problem is to try and reclaim the public idea space from extremist voices that predominate there currently. The images that we all get to consume from the region are almost entirely images of Palestinians angry at Israelis and Israelis angry at Palestinians. And these images contribute to a sense of irreconcilable difference between the two communities, and a sense of hopelessness about resolution of the conflict.
Dr. Wexler went on to explain how A Different Futures approach departs from more traditional grassroots efforts.
I think actually there's a poet in your area, I think she lives in Houston, a Palestinian-American poet, Naomi Shihab Nye, who puts the problem very succinctly. She wrote, "Moderate voices have to speak more loudly. We have to shout as moderates, though it's not our style." Now, our organization thinks that the way that moderates should shout is through a sophisticated, professionally developed communication plan. So what we have done is we have brought together religious leaders, scholars who are experts in the area, and communications experts, communications people who have done things like anti-drug campaigns, teen tobacco campaigns. We have as one of our advisors the former head of the Ad Council, which is the nonprofit volunteer social service arm of the advertising industry nationally. We think it's that technology, the same technology and communications expertise that we've developed to such a fine way in this country to convince people, for example, that they should drink Coca-Cola instead of Pepsi or Pepsi instead of Coca-Cola. It's that expertise that moderates should use when we contest the battlefield of ideas and try and reclaim it from extremist voices. So that's our primary strategy, our primary mission.
A Different Future, in addition to its media focus, has also planned an upcoming event, which Dr. Wexler explained to us.
Well, the major activity which we have planned for this September, actually, in Washington, September 15th and 16th, is a walk in Washington where the walking groups are going to consist of representatives of the Muslim, Jewish, and Christian communities. There would be in each walking group, for example, an imam, a rabbi, a priest, and a minister. These are to be locally self-constituted local groups so that the imam, the rabbi, the priest, and the minister would all come from the same community. But right away, we think that this will help to build interfaith bridges across communities, in communities across the country. Our plan is to have 250 of these walking units, 1,000 religious leaders, leaders of the religious communities in Washington, September 15th and 16th. There will be a website called walkinwashington.info, and that will be a place where people can actually get information and sign up. And we're just launching this now. You're the first. This is a scoop in a way. The first discussion publicly we've had of this, and we're hoping that there'll be a large contingent from Texas. And what people need to do, or find this idea they'd like to support, is to speak to their own religious leaders. And any single religious leader can initiate this by then reaching out to leaders in his or her own community from the other faiths and forming a walking group.
Professor Bruce Wexler's recent article about media coverage can be found in Columbia Journalism Review, which is online at cjr.org, and the website of his organization is www.adifferentfuture.org. This is Farah Charmchi for KPFT Pacifica Radio.
Would you harbor me? Would I harbor you? Would you harbor me? Would I harbor you? Would you harbor a Christian, a Muslim, a Jew, a heretic, convict, or spy? Would you harbor a runaway woman or child, a poet, a prophet, a king? Would you harbor an exile or a refugee, a person living with AIDS? Would you harbor a Tubman, a Garrett, a truth, a fugitive, or a slave?
Sweet Honey in the Rock, Would You Harbor Me? Last Saturday marked the third anniversary of World Refugee Day. The day was created by the United Nations to celebrate and acknowledge the experiences of refugees. This year's theme was Refugee Youth, Building the Future. In Washington, D.C., festivities were held at the Josephine Butler Center. Attendees included refugees, healthcare workers, educators, and supporters who were there to recognize the contributions of refugees throughout the world. Peace Watch correspondent Benta Berkland was there and files this report.
Fatimata Kamara fled to Nigeria from Sierra Leone at the age of 16. She lived in a refugee camp for 5 years and immigrated to the U.S. last month.
If you're in the refugee camp, you are hopeless. You don't know what to do. You're not thinking of going to school. You're just sitting down there praying to God for the time God will take you from there. People are dying of hunger, no food, no medical assistance, no scholarship, and it was not easy for me.
Minyabihi Ford is a bilingual health educator with the Ethiopian Community Development Center. She came to the U.S. from Ethiopia and believes the U.S. can one day be a beautiful country once people truly embrace diversity.
This is really very difficult time for America and its image in the world because of what's taking place now. But domestically, we really have to be very careful. Just the other day we celebrated, I believe it was a couple that was executed because they were suspected of being communist in the 50s. Somebody actually died because of fear and terror and not knowledge. And you would never think it could happen in America.
Critics of policies implemented by the Bush administration in its fight against terror are concerned that laws such as the USA Patriot Act, the federal anti-terrorism legislation, infringe on privacy and individual freedoms. Ford explains how the current climate affects refugees' integration into American society and reshapes their conceptions of the U.S.
The American public is more sensitive, more suspicious. The newcomers are more fearful because they feel like, I came here to get away from that. We really have to back off, think, really be deliberate about our actions, and our statements. Because if I misunderstand what you said and I report to the police, I ruin your life. Because I'm thinking I'm doing something positive, because I don't want terrorists to attack me or anyone. Lack of knowledge, ignorance, I think is going to lead us a wrong path. And I'm hoping the more people discuss, the more they demystify the differences that they perceive, not that actually exist among people.
According to the U.S. Committee for Refugees, in 2000, at least 34.5 million people had to flee their homelands because of war, poverty, and human rights abuses. And that number is on the rise. Last year, the U.S. had the lowest refugee admission in 2 decades, in part because of stepped-up security screenings combined with travel restrictions for government officials responsible for identifying eligible refugees. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, this is Benta Berkland.
Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons, taking the train to Tibet. Our associate producer is Angelique Chauffard. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Adel Hammett of KPFA, Keith Chalgian, Matilda Bradshaw, Renee Feltz, and Christopher Sprinkle. If you'd like to support Peace Watch, we urge you to make a pledge through our secure online website at pacifica.org. Or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C. 20009. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.